This time of year, a good hoodie is absolutely essential, but it's tough to find one that will last through the season. That's why the American Giant Classic Full Zip Hoodie is made to last a lifetime, so you can count on it to bring you comfort and warmth year after year. Slate Magazine called it the greatest hoodie ever made, and from cotton to zipper, it's made right here in the USA. With timeless style, heavyweight fleece, a double-lined hood, and reinforced elbow patches, you can depend on it for years to come. Snag the hoodie that will bring you comfort for life, the American Giant Classic Full Zip, and save 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use code CLASSIC24 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code CLASSIC24.
Every day when you log into ChumbaCasino.com, the ultimate online social casino, you get a free daily bonus. Imagine if you got daily bonuses in other parts of your life.
I chose French fries over loaded French fries.
I asked Stuart from accounting about his weekend, even though I don't care.
I updated my operating system without having to call tech support.
Collect your free daily bonus at ChumbaCasino.com now. And live the Chumba life. VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex. Welcome back to On Air. Pleased to be with you and happy Wednesday to you and yours. How have you been, Dan?
I am good. How are you?
Not too bad. Not too bad. There's so much going on in the world of aviation, but a lot of that we might save for next week, because this week we are going to get down to business. And by getting down to business, I mean the airline miles and points business. We have some exclusives coming up, I know, because we've got a great guest from Air France.
We do.
How about I let you tee things up for us?
So today we are joined by, this is going to be so fun and so interesting. We're joined by Benjamin Lipsey, the head of Flying Blue, SVP of loyalty at Air France KLM. Flying Blue is obviously their loyalty program, and you will learn so much in this interview. Whether or not you're very familiar with the miles and points world as it is, this will be an eye-opening conversation. If you live, whether you live in Europe or the US, or whether you have credit cards or you don't, whether you fly Air France KLM or you don't, it's going to be good.
And the good thing is that I know, because we've been discussing and arranging this chat for a while, for many of us, and I guess this is quite a bit relevant between the differences between you and I, for example, I am much less in that world of miles and points. But when you are able to make it as easy to understand as I know you are, Dan, and as I know Ben is about to be in our conversation, then you quickly realize how it can have an impact on, for example, our lives when we're traveling. And we're not talking about the basic stuff, but also we're talking about how it works in different markets, right? Because we are a global podcast with listeners from all over the world. And whether or not you live, reside, or even visit France, Flying Blue is one of those kind of staple airline loyalty programs, along with so many others, that touches every continent and you have some form of involvement with, or you can benefit from, as I say, even if you're not due to go to Paris this year. And that's why I think it's really relevant to kind of, I guess the conversation is going to be both insightful but also educational, and even for me, as you said.
Yeah, I love how you don't consider yourself part of the points world. You don't care about it that much. But then every time, like a couple times a month, you're like, Dan, how did you pay for that flight you just took in Emirates first class?
Well, it's highly suspicious.
Flying this or that? And you start getting suspicious, and I'm like, listen up, let me tell you how this works, you know?
Okay, that is true. And also, you are still my go-to guy when I need to transfer points from out of Qatar into BA across to Finnair and so on. So there's room for all of us to learn, but specifically for a big airline program that I'm not so familiar with. So let's get to the chat. I'm not going to be able to be present for the chat itself. I'm going to let you take the lead, but I'll be back for the roundup. And then, of course, we'll dive into some Q&A.
Sounds good. Let's dive right in. Ben Lipsey, welcome to On Air. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Dan. I'm really happy to be here.
Can you just give us a general overview to start with? I'm sure everyone listening knows what Flying Blue is, but do you want to present what the program is in your own words in the grand scheme of the loyalty world?
Yeah, sure. So Flying Blue, we're the loyalty program of Air France and KLM. We have 26 million members. We have one new member every 5 seconds. We have primarily a membership base based in Europe, which comes as no surprise, being we're a loyalty program for two big European carriers. But interestingly enough, we have a good chunk of our members also based in the US. This has been growing in recent years, which I'm happy to see. So we were the first to have, dynamic pricing in Europe, whereby every seat is available in miles. We have, as you probably know, a lot of transfer partners in the US, just all the big banks. We're, constantly looking for ways to make sure that our program is attractive and usable, and that we can find new ways to appeal to members and engage them.
That's great. 26 million members is incredible. I like that you brought up the US there a bit, because obviously loyalty programs in the US are more profitable than the flying themselves. Airlines really, through their credit card deals and their loyalty programs, it goes a long way. And one thing I've never really had the opportunity to ask is, how does that compare to Europe? Because obviously the credit card market is not as lucrative, but is there, to what degree is Flying Blue a huge asset to Air France KLM?
Oh, so how much detail do you want?
As much as you want to give.
You've opened the door to a few things there, so I'm happy to walk through it. So first and foremost, yes, I mean, Flying Blue, we are an asset, both, obviously from a strategic perspective, but also financially to Air France and KLM, or to the Air France KLM group. We actually, as of end of last year, we actually were able to kind of carve out the entity for which that issues miles. So in other words, Flying Blue as a loyalty program entity now exists independent from Air France and KLM. This was notable for a few reasons. One, it's the first time outside of the US that this was done at such a large scale. We worked with Apollo, which is a US private equity firm. So they were, they were able to help with the quasi-equity transaction, pardon me, where we were able to raise 1.5 billion euros, which allowed us to do a couple of things. One, it allowed us to break out the loyalty program entity out of the airlines, which meant that we could actually recognize the equity on our balance sheet. Previously, it was just rolled up into the performance of the airlines, which was good for them, and for us, it didn't make a huge difference. But now, we can leverage the value of Flying Blue as positive equity for the group. In addition, it allows us to monitor their performance. It's now on our balance sheet. So if you look at our results, our financial results, you now see it broken out specifically for Flying Blue. And I'm proud to, proud to mark to remark that on our last results, which were November 7th last week, that we had a 27.5% operating margin for Flying Blue, which is the most profitable business unit for the group. And if you exclude the airline revenue, which is the revenue that we earn from the miles that we sell to Air France and KLM, which are at a much lower cost. Our third-party revenue margin is around 50%. So we're really, really happy to hear that, and happy to monitor this, which is, really strong performance.
So just to build off that, I'd love to hear what you're going to say, but do you think that the loyalty market in Europe will grow and grow to become more like the US over time?
So good question. And that's exactly what I was gonna say. So to your point about credit cards, this is why, I mean, without a doubt, this is why the US loyalty market has been able to grow into what it is. You have in the US, there's three ways the banks make money with credit cards. You have obviously the card fees, you have the interest on outstanding balances, and as a responsible consumer, of course, you should never be paying interest on your balances, but there are those that do. Which then allows the bank to finance, more purchases and more generosity of miles. And then last but not least, you have the interchange fees, which is the fees that the merchants pay to accept credit cards. And in the US, they're not capped. So on average, you're looking at, between 2.5-3.5% per transaction. In Europe, interchange fees are capped at a European level at 0.3%. So a tenth of what they are in the US. You don't have revolving credit card balances. I mean, 90% of cards that are in the market are debit cards, and even those that are considered, credit are not true credit cards in most markets. So you don't have the same interest income that you do in the US. So you're really only able to finance based on card fees. And so when you look at the strength of the banks in the US and the ability with which they've been able to finance miles, they've entered this, you know, kind of alliance with the airlines or other co-brand partners, which allows them to have created such generosity such that people have become miles obsessed, right? Yeah. In Europe, not only do you have a different financial structure, so you have not had the buildup of credit card rewards the same way you've had in the US, but you also culturally have differences of attitudes towards debt. So people in certain countries don't like carrying debt. They don't like consumer debt. They prefer to pay with cash or cash equivalent, i.e. debit. You also, as a result, have not had the growth of credit card rewards and what that means in terms of consumer culture.
Yeah.
So in North America, I mean, I'm Canadian, so similar culture to the US, you know, we think about points for everything, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you maximize your points? How do I earn more? You see certain stores, and I can think of one example in Canada where the LCBO, which is the biggest liquor board in Canada, bearing in mind you can only purchase alcohol at a government store.
Sweden.
Same as Sweden. You don't need a loyalty program because it's a monopoly. And yet, Aeroplan was able to insert themselves in that market, which is fantastic for them. And, you know, but it shows you that consumers have an expectation of a loyalty program, even at a monopoly, right?
Yeah.
In Europe, you know, anecdotally, I have friends who love flying Air France or love flying KLM, and, you know, they are, you know, lawyers or whatever, and so they were able to pay for the tickets. And yet, when I asked them, you know, what status are you? They said, oh, I'm not a member of Flying Blue, almost as if it was a dirty word. Because for them, it's a... You know, I don't want to be considered as cheap, or I don't want to be considered as, you know, that person who's just in it to earn the miles. So there's a different culture or attitude. Yeah. And, you know, so once I kind of explained that he was leaving money on the table, you know, he became our biggest ambassador. But, you know, it culturally, it took some time to kind of get this message across. And so we in Europe have a challenge of not only trying to find ways to finance our miles in a different way than the US, but also trying to get people on board with, you know, joining our program.
Yeah.
So what I am pleased to say, and I'll use this as a bit of a plug, is that, you know, when you look at Flying Blue, we might have fewer members than some of our competitors, but from an active member perspective, we outperform. So, you know, not to name any names, but I was in Dallas earlier this week at a Skift conference, and one of the big US loyalty programs was saying they have over 100 million members,
yeah.
But something like 17 million were active. And, you know, we have 26 million, but we have between a third and a half which are active,
yeah.
Right? Based on the time period. And so for us, like, it just goes to show you that maybe we have fewer members, but we are able to successfully and keep them engaged at a, you know, much higher rate. Which for us, really, at the end of the day, it's your engaged members who are the ones that you care about.
Yeah.
So back to your question, you know, do I think that the market will eventually move towards one like in the US? Hard to say. I think unless or until, you know, credit cards are treated differently or you know, are been able to find new ways to finance the miles, it's a lot harder because that's really the big driver of rewards programs. But I think if we can find ways to continue to engage members on a regular basis, you can keep them more actively engaged.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I have a million.
Sorry, it's a lot of information.
Yeah, we've unleashed the loyalty beasts here because, yeah, that was so many interesting things you said there. I mean, okay, just to unpack some of the things. First of all, when we're talking about the low credit card merchant fees in Europe that you mentioned at the beginning, I find that very interesting in the context of the US having this bipartisan bill that seems to have stalled a bit, but proposing lowering merchant fees in the US.
Yeah.
There's, of course, panic in the credit card industry.
Of course. Yeah.
But that considered... It, as you said, in some cases, the fee is 10 times lower in Europe, but credit cards are nowhere near 10 times less rewarding. The credit cards are less rewarding, sure, but it's not 10 times worse. It's maybe half or a third, you know? So that's an interesting argument, right?
So yes and no. So you're correct that it depends. So you'll notice that, you know, for us, for example, we have our partnership with Amex. As does, you know, SAS, for example, in Sweden. Alitalia for a while was with Amex, with Eaton now. I'm not sure who their partner is, but it's because Amex is not currently capped in Europe. It's because of the fact it's considered a three-party scheme as opposed to a four-party scheme, which covers Visa and MasterCard. Of course, you can imagine there's intense lobbying efforts to buy Visa and MasterCard to ensure that Amex is treated the same. But for now, that's not the case. But even with Amex in Europe, the it's not the same. It's not. I can tell you, it's not 3%. It's lower than that. But where you have, a MasterCard or a Visa, which you'll notice with Lufthansa, for example, in Germany, you earn one the base card. You earn 1 mile for every 2 euro spent, right? So it's basically half a mile per euro, and the euro is now approaching a dollar, unfortunately for us. But you can it's fewer miles for a richer currency, just to kind of highlight the gap. And it's because the banks have it's based on either a different relationship with them, or it's based on the card fees, which tend to be a lot higher. The $95 kind of sweet spot that you find in the US for the entry-level airline cards don't exist here. They're usually a lot more expensive. So it's again it's a market that's a lot more challenging.
I mean, you guys have now obviously got a bit closer to SAS with the acquisition of 20%, right, of SAS. They, interestingly, this is, I'm not giving any hints here or anything, but they have a MasterCard that I consider to be probably the most rewarding MasterCard in Europe. It has about a 50, 150 or 200 euro annual fee. But if you earn 200,000, I guess you know about this, but if you earn 200,000 points a year, you get basically business class awards for the price of economy, which is
Oh,
incredible
interesting.
for long haul. You know, I don't know how this
Absolutely.
thing works, but it makes me think, of course, I have a lot of Scandinavian viewers. And besides SAS, just can we expect to see a Flying Blue credit card in Scandinavia at some point now that you're so closely partnered with SAS?
So good question. I have no information to announce at the moment, but I can just say, stay tuned. We are always looking to grow our co-brand proposition. We have 11 different co-brands in the market around the world, amongst the higher end of airlines. So for us, it's something that we're always looking to say, how do we grow our presence, particularly in other European markets? So at the moment, no, I have no further information, but like I said, I mean, never say never.
Obviously, a lot of people also asked down the line, there's been discussion, or I guess conspiracy theories about SAS potentially adopting Flying Blue as their loyalty program. But I'm assuming you don't have any breaking news on that yet.
No, not yet. Look, I'm not going to lie. I mean, when we were looking at the transaction, certainly the synergies and loyalty was a big plus for this 20% stake. I will say that because it's only a 20% stake, we don't have antitrust. We don't have any controlling influence on SAS. So for the moment, there's no, be very blunt, there's no plans to do anything further than the partnership that we have today. Again, never say never. Certainly, there are ideas that we have, but for now, there's nothing that's been identified or solidified. So, and until we have over a 50% stake, there's nothing that we can, there's nothing that we'll be able to influence.
I mean, you're a loyalty geek. Has it ever crossed your mind that there could be a competitor to Avios, for example, where you have the same currency used between different airlines with different programs? But as you know, it creates an incredibly valuable ecosystem for all the airlines involved.
Yes, we have looked at that model very seriously. That's all I'll say.
Okay. Well, I think a lot of people would be excited about that. And also you mentioned earlier about some people in Europe feeling cheap, or like they come off as cheap if they're interested in loyalty. I understand that. I've spent many frustrating hours trying to convince my family in Sweden not only to sign up for frequent flyer programs, but even
There you go.
credit cards. And for some reason, trying to convince them to get a card is just impossible, even when you try to show them the benefits.
So it's funny because I mean, you have, I guess, both European and American, background. And so in the US, the average consumer has something like seven different credit cards. And it's one for your grocery store, one for your airline, one for your hotel. Like, because people don't will open cards without really thinking twice about it. And at least in France, it's the average person has like one. You know, I mean, maybe too, because they're funded, if even, because they're fundamentally linked to your bank account. You know, you can't really, again, Amex aside, you can't really get a card from a bank that's different from like your bank account. And it's just considered an extension of that. So, you know, for people to have multiple cards, again, unless you have accounts in different banks for various reasons, it's not something people would generally think about.
It doesn't make sense to me. You know, I had to literally sit down and force my mother-in-law to apply for an SAS Amex. I said, look, you'll get these points. It will get you a free one-way ticket to London, all this stuff.
There you go.
And then a year later, when the annual fee comes around, I hear she's closed it. And I'm like, oh my God. Then, of course, that was like 2018. Now, years later, she goes, oh, I heard on some podcast that it's good to have credit cards. Like, I'm like, this is what I've been saying for years.
Maybe when it comes to me, it doesn't count, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But how do you think that you can encourage the European market to get more involved with this stuff? Because there's so much untapped potential.
Huge. Yeah, no, I fully agree. So, you know, I think it's about trying to show the value. You know, a lot of people here, like I said, culturally, it's just not in the DNA at the moment, loyalty programs to fully kind of embrace them. I mean, even find, you know, the more successful loyalty programs, you know, here in France or with the grocery stores, for example, or even some of the department stores. And even then, you know, you'll have things like, oh, your points are only, you know, valid for 3 months after the date of purchase. And so again, if you're coming from a market where it encourages people to sign up and to collect and all of this, again, it's you have to change the buying behavior and also the way the rewards are perceived. Because, you know, the benefit of an airline rewards program is that, you know, we're not just here helping you save, you know, $5 at the grocery store. It's, you know, we allow you to travel around the world. We allow you to upgrade yourself to business. We allow you to, you know, travel on different airlines, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's the message that we sell. Because loyalty at the base of it is fundamentally, it's an aspirational reward. It's an aspirational redemption. And, you know, you as a customer go, look what I was able to get, you know, for free, quote unquote, because obviously, you know, there are some catches, sure. But it's, you know, people like to think, I didn't pay for this, or I didn't pay full price, or I got a deal. And, you know, that's why, for example, I'm a super big fan of not having a concrete value on loyalty currency. There are loyalty programs who have they say your points are worth a fixed amount, you know, whether in the hotel space or the airline space, and they say, you know exactly how much your points are worth, and therefore you're able to get a redemption. It's very easy. You see this with some of the proprietary credit cards, for example, and it's true. It is fundamentally a simpler value proposition. But on the whole, I'm fundamentally against that model. Because as a loyalty marketer, you remove any emotional triggers, right? You remove the aspirational redemption of being able to go for a flight in first class or a hut, you know, in the Maldives over the water or whatever it is. You remove that kind of halo effect because you say, well, if my points are worth a fixed, you know, cent per point value, you know that sure it's great. I can redeem off any rate. I can, you know, whatever it is. But it's not a you lose that emotional trigger, which for us, we what at least what I refer to as irrational behavior, right? If you're a customer and you're saying, well, I'm going to decide to fly with Air France or KLM, even if they're more expensive or even if they're a little bit less convenient because I want my points, either status, currency, or miles, you have become in my mind an irrational consumer because a rational consumer would take the cheapest price or the, you know, most convenient timing, whatever it is. And so the loyalty, our role is to be able to say, how do I incentivize you to make a decision that you otherwise wouldn't make? And so if you go back to that idea about, you know, making the value of points, you remove that whole ability. And so, you know, to your point about the CCCA in the US, it's the same idea, you know, or it's the same idea about saying if you attach a fixed value to a point, again, you kind of remove a lot of the inherent value of what a loyalty program is meant to do.
Precisely. Yeah, it's not just about earning some return. And you know, this
Yeah.
is why a lot of people in who are interested in loyalty like you, obviously, because there need to be these aspirational redemptions, and you understand
Yeah.
that. I feel like, or do you feel like to some extent in Europe, this can also be blamed on, you know, loyalty programs are a thing that has become bigger and bigger in the past few decades. And in that
Yeah.
time, Europe has had Ryanair and EasyJet. And I'm just thinking to some extent, flying is so different in Europe compared to the US, and how people mm-hmm. look at flying in Europe because of what these airlines have done.
Yeah. So, sorry. So interestingly enough, none of the low-cost carriers, the LCCs, none of them have a traditional loyalty program, as far as I'm aware. They have subscription-based models. You know, for example, you can purchase a bundle of benefits for a fixed fee or a monthly fee, which gives you things like priority boarding or an extra piece of luggage. But none of them have the traditional kind of points-based program, which, like you say, is from a market that is very, very, it's much more competitive in a different way in Europe. It's surprising because, again, I mean, you'd think, you know, why not, right? Since the model works so well for legacy carriers.
I was more thinking the way that people view flying is a lot of people, at least I know, speaking anecdotally,
yeah.
they just want to get the cheapest ticket. So
yeah.
people are not loyal to one airline. And
yes.
your general citizen is not loyal in the same sense as they might, you know, in the US, even if they're not fully loyal to one, they might have a preference if they live in a city that is not a fortress hub from one of them, you know, they might.
So, still... Interesting. I have a different approach. I mean, I certainly can relate to what you say. And I think there is a lot more pricing pressure because of the pricing of some of our low cost competitors. But I think in Europe, it's actually a bit different from the US in a different sense. I think in Europe, you have, you know, many countries have a kind of a flag carrier, right? So in France, it's yeah. Air France, and in the Netherlands, it's KLM. Obviously in Sweden, you know, it would be SAS. And there's almost this national pride in flying your home carrier in many cases, whether it's because it's a pride or because you think, you know, they understand you from a cultural perspective and the food and the service reflects that, you know, whatever it is. There is a sense of, you know, this is the home carrier, this is better. You know, if I had the money, I would choose to fly them. And it shocked me because on short and medium haul flights, so within Europe, I fully agree, with the exception of maybe a paid snack or bag. Realistically, I mean, it's for an hour, 2 hour flight, they're all kind of the same.
Yeah.
But there is this opinion amongst a lot of people that, you know, oh no, but Air France is definitely, you know, better, definitely higher end. And yeah, sure. I mean, we have that image and that's great. But on a, you know, 1 or 2 hour flight, you know, I agree with you. The number of people that are willing to pay the premium is perhaps not as high as it would be on a long haul flight. Yeah. But it does still exist, right? And that perception really exists. Whereas I think in the US, again, it's just my two cents, but I think, you know, you don't really have one national carrier. And like you say, you might have a preference that is driven by loyalty or driven certainly by schedule if you live in a hub. But the loyalty to saying, oh, this carrier is definitely better, or this one is definitely kind of the national brand of the country, it doesn't resonate in the same way, at least in my opinion.
No, I think you're right. I'm speaking from the perspective of having grown up in Gothenburg, which basically Alex is going to roll his eyes when he hears this. But basically, even though SAS is our national carrier, we have more daily flights from Lufthansa, for example, and more.
Yeah, there you go.
So that's why I think, from my perspective, people don't have that. But I totally recognize what you're saying. And that's also another frustration for me sometimes when I review airlines and people are so blindly loyal to SAS, for example, as Swedes. Just, oh, I love it because it feels like home. And then I'm like, but just try something else because you might love that as well. And I've noticed so much now with the transition of SAS over into SkyTeam, how people have been reluctantly hopping on board the Air France KLM train and then realizing actually this was better than what it was before, but people were just so attached to their partner airline.
That's the point. Yeah. Absolutely. And it shows you the power of loyalty, right? I mean, if they were traveling, you know, Star Alliance carriers, because of course SAS is linked with Star, then of course, and they're going to say, you know, nobody likes change. And so it's, you know, you have to kind of get over the hump. But when you realize, hey, you know, our product is really good. And yes, it's a short haul flight, but we do find ways to make the difference. And, you know, we do offer certain benefits and all of this, which are different and in our view, you know, competitive advantages to our European competitors. It's not so bad. But like you say, I mean, it's, you have to get yourself out there and you'll be willing to change. Exactly. And again, loyalty works to prevent people from making those decisions, right? So,
yeah. Yep. So going back to the kind of discussion about the points market in Europe, obviously, I think since you became head of Flying Blue, I've noticed more of an emphasis on ways to acquire points without needing credit cards, which I think is very sensible. So there has been for a long time the ability to buy points, but I guess last year you introduced the ability to boost, and then just last month you introduced a subscription model for acquiring points. Yep. Do you want to talk a bit about the motivations behind that?
Yeah. So, I mean, financial, really. I mean, you know, there's for us, you know, it's look, the way I look at loyalty is we have two KPIs. Very, you know, quite simply, we have our indirect revenue and our direct revenue. Our indirect revenue is all of the money that we generate for our airlines, Air France and KLM, by encouraging people to pick us when we're, like I said, more expensive or less convenient or what have you. And that really is just getting people to pay more for their tickets, I mean, quite simply. And we see that just by joining joining Flying Blue, on average, customers spend about 9% more and just by becoming a member, right? Wow. And that value, that what we call loyalty value, increases, of course, as you move up the tier pyramid, meaning you go from, you know, Explorer to Silver to Gold to Platinum to Ultimate. And this, in addition to just the amount of money you spend on your tickets, because obviously a Platinum is going to fly more than a Silver. But this is that additional revenue that we attribute to you because you're a tier member or a loyalty member, because you're willing to spend more because you want your status points, your XP or your miles, or you want your benefits. That's what we attribute. And it's you know, just by joining the base tier, it's 9%. And like I said, it goes up as you move up. So that's the indirect revenue. And that revenue is not attributed to Flying Blue. It's revenue that we give to the airlines or that we generate for the airlines. And that's the fundamental basis of why loyalty programs were created, right? More recently, there's been more of an emphasis on creating direct revenue, and this is why you've seen the value of loyalty programs skyrocket in the US, driven almost exclusively by credit cards and other ways of monetizing miles. Mm-hmm. And in Europe, obviously for, you know, reasons I've already explained, it's been a little bit more slow. But the logic remains the same. It's how do we find ways to sell more miles to partners or directly?
Yeah.
So, you know, we recently launched a partnership with Uber in our home markets. We have a partnership with Amazon in our home markets, as well as Sweden, where you can earn miles on your Amazon purchases, which, again, is unique for the airline industry. No other airline has a partnership with Amazon. You know, so we've tried to find ways to have more daily lifestyle partners. We have a partnership with a company called Points Pay, mm-hmm. which is from a technical perspective, it's quite cool. It's where, you know, you might be familiar with some of the affiliate models where you have to log into Flying Blue and then you click on the link and then it will take you to your merchant. And it works, but it's a bit cumbersome. And, you know, with more data protection and anti-cookie rules, I mean, that model might have limits in the future. Whereas with Points Pay, it's a tool where the merchant can actually integrate the pay with points or earn points directly into the checkout flow. Nice. So you'll have, you know, with Rituals, for example, our skincare brand based in the Netherlands, you know, you purchase your products in the basket. And then when you check out, it'll say credit card, you know, PayPal or pay with points. And there you can either, you sign into Flying Blue and you can either pay directly with your points or you can earn points on that transaction, double dipping if you have a co-brand. Mm-hmm. So again, it's trying to find ways that are more, a little bit more unique, a little bit more adapted to the European market. That allow members to earn points every day through partnerships, and then to, you know, to what you just said, we've also been able to introduce ways for members to, you know, get more engaged on a regular basis directly, and that's where we have tried to adapt our sale of points directly to consumers, looking at pricing strategies, bonus strategies, and now of course with a subscription.
I love that idea. First of all, I'm going to check on adding that to my course. I'm kidding, but it would be nice for people to earn double dip points on that. I think it's amazing, personally, offering many different models for acquiring points. Obviously, as you know, the new subscription model is the lowest price that you guys offer points at, because it is hard to build a substantial balance in Europe. Mm-hmm. So for people to be able to boost that or just come in and engage with the program in other ways, it's amazing. What is the reaction of partner airlines when you do something like this? Maybe it's not very noticeable yet, but obviously there are some loyalty programs, as you'll know, like Avianca Life Miles, that really, the main part of the business is selling points. And different partner airlines are different, have varying levels of enthusiasm about that, right?
So yeah, I mean, some airlines, they stick to the traditional model, which is to say, look, we're here to generate revenue for the airlines, and there is some focus, and it's always the give and take with the revenue management teams to say, look, we by selling points certainly at a at an attract a price that might be deemed too attractive, you devalue the actual cash purchase price. There are always going to be some people that will say, look, I'm gonna choose to purchase a ticket with points versus cash because you're gonna do the math. And my personal view is such that I don't think there's a huge overlap. Yes, certainly you're gonna get the points optimizers and those that are constantly looking back and forth at the points in cash versus points in miles. But my personal view is that you have consumers who are traveling for business travel, for example. And in that case, it's a, the company is the one that's buying the ticket. You can't expense, miles purchases,
Yeah.
right? So in that instance, you're going to purchase a cash ticket. If you are traveling, for leisure, again, it's the same thing. You're going, I want to go on the date that I want to fly. I have a particular vacation that I want to make. And I'm not going to try to worry about finding points inventory. I just want to book. And so you're gonna book a cash ticket. I think where it's is the people that have saved up and the people that book in really far in advance that are going to say, look, I'm looking for a deal. I want to go away. I'm a bit more flexible. And that's not everybody. So for us, it's again, it's we have to find the ways to best optimize this. I'll be the first one to say we don't want to sell a seat in miles that we could otherwise have sold for cash. That's we are a business at the end of the day. But it's just trying to find that balance. Loyalty programs traditionally were built around trying to fill empty seats, right? Because on average, your load factor might be in the 70s or 80s. If you're lucky in the 90s, but if you go too high, again, you're spilling, which means you've sold seats for too cheap, right? You could have otherwise sold for more money. So you are trying to find that optimal load factor. And then the loyalty program is that generally there to fill seats that would otherwise have gone unsold. And you have, the traditional model whereby only a certain number of seats are made available per flight. You see this with, some of our European competitors, not to name any names, but you know who I'm talking about. And, there's some of them have seat guarantees or some of them have some other kind of, tools to help you manage availability or find availability. But at the end of the day, some of the biggest gripes that people have is that there's never any seats when I want to fly. It's a way of saying, how do I mitigate that demand? Because without giving away every seat on the plane to for points when I could have sold it and made more money. So for us, we act as a travel agency of sorts by selling tickets. We're the biggest customer. The loyalty program is the biggest customer in the airline. And it's just trying to say how do we manage selling points at a price that we're able to make margin. And certainly the higher the bundle that you purchase, generally the price goes down, obviously. But also to manage that in such a way that you have access to inventory, and that's what we try to do. I just did a presentation on this. We have something like, I think it's like 30%, 31% of our inventory and economy is available in our entry level, whereas 12% in business. But the bookings are more than double. The number of bookings or the percentage of bookings that we have on our entry level are 50% or whatever it is in economy, and like I think it's like 35% in business. Yes. You have more people competing for fewer seats. But that's why we're always trying to say, can we optimize by making sure that we're appropriately priced, both to the consumer, but also that we're paying revenue management enough that they're willing to give us more inventory, right? So we are looking at, to give you an example, there's a model where we're considering saying, okay, if we raise the amount of money that we pay to revenue management for our entry level, they are happier to give us more inventory because they're willing to get more money for the seat. Whereas, and it might mean that we have to raise prices a little bit on the consumer side, but if we can show that there's a significant increase in availability, is that worth the trade-off? Right? So these are the
Interesting.
kind of things that we're always trying to optimize because, it's like saying you can fill a seat at $1, 1 euro, doesn't mean you're going to be profitable, right? So it's always you're trying to find that balance between the cash and the miles price. Both for the consumer as well as internally.
Do I hear that you might be trying a model where we would get more space, but would that come with an increase in points price or an increase in the cash component?
No, the model we're looking at is an increase in points. It's not, we're not talking about 50% or 100% increase. or more as we see in some of the US programs. But it would be more than it is now on the low end, but you'd have much more inventory. So, this is it's always a balance because I'm very well aware that, if you're not priced attractively on the low end, for those that are earning miles by converting from credit cards, they have choice. There's 15, 20 different airlines that they can convert to. And if you're not attractively priced, then of course they're going to go somewhere else. That's where, we make a lot of money from these transactional customers rather than loyal customers. But at the end of the day, we also see that once they've flown on us from a conversion ticket, as it were, they're like 20% more likely to buy a cash ticket. So there is a benefit to get them on board as well. But all this to say that when you have tools like, Point.me or Cicero or whatever, where you're able to see like an OTA where you're democratizing the points booking process, that if you don't have an attractive offer, if you're not, if your price isn't in the box or on the shelf, as it were, you're skipped over. So it is something we pay very close attention to, and something I've told the team, look, you can't just put a price out there and be like, this is what it is. No, you have to make sure we're competitive. But at the same time, I'm not going to sell every seat in business class for 50,000 points. It's, you lose money that way. So it's trying to find that balance.
Right. So basically, I mean, I know you can't give away everything, but we're talking about a bigger release of saver seats in exchange for potentially a higher price, and then you'll
Correct.
still keep the dynamic pricing for
Correct.
additional seats.
Yes, but so we are already working towards a model that, for those of you who are revenue management geeks in the audience, a model called continuous pricing. And this has actually already gone live in a few markets. And it's dynamic pricing, but what it does is it smooths the curve or smooths the gap between the different buckets. So it's airline pricing has evolved such that it's no longer just based on booking class. So you can have several different prices for booking class. But with continuous pricing, the jumps between each level are smoother, without getting too much into the details. So what that means is rather than saying, oh, you go from 50 to 70 to 110 or whatever, you might see, 65 or, 73 or like some of these other ones, because we're able to get lower pricing internally, which means we can then transfer, like convert that price into a lower miles price. So for us, it's a way of trying to say, can we offer more inventory, even if it's at a slightly higher price in the entry level, but then also in the dynamic space, once the entry level is no longer there, can we smoothen the curve so that it's a lot like smaller gaps in between them, which should then help the consumers have less sizable jumps between pricing levels.
I really like that. That's one thing I was thrilled to see with the Virgin Atlantic Flying Club redesign, that you have one day the flight is 53,000, the next day it's 54. So there's such little increments, which I think is a great idea. So we're running out of time here. I could speak forever, but one common thread through everyone's questions was I'm a Flying Blue Platinum member. Obviously, I have a lot of viewers and we have a lot of listeners who are Flying Blue Platinum members. And I'm sure you see this because you spend time on Flyer Talk and stuff, but
Of course, yeah.
people are asking the difference between gold and platinum ultimately isn't that big, especially considering the difference in what you have to earn to acquire platinum status compared to gold. Is there, are you looking at ways to make gold or sorry, platinum more attractive, or is that on the vision board?
Short answer is yes. I mean, I think, when I came into Flying Blue, that was actually one of the key things I had actually already identified, was that the difference between gold and platinum was effectively, an extra mile per year, and that was it. We spent the last little bit, trying to really focus on differentiating our tiers, including by fully, better positioning our ultimate tier status. So ultimate is when you fly three times more than platinum. For a while it was a tier I wasn't convinced was competitive. Now I think we've really made strides, and we're continuing to say, how do we add value there? But that's not at the expense of platinum, and it does not mean that we've forgotten platinum either. I mean, I think we have a lot of platinum customers, a lot of gold customers, and of course I thank them all for their business. It's why I have a job. It's for me, it's certainly something that we try to actively reevaluate. So, just this year, we've introduced a couple new benefits for Platinums as well. We introduced the waiving of all changes and refunds fees on award tickets. Previously, they had to pay, 30 euros or 50 euros a ticket. I think it was 50 euros. Now they don't, if you're booking the miles from a Platinum members account. We also introduced a second piece of baggage when traveling on Air France and KLM. Yes, it's not the same level as Ultimate, but it is something which does further differentiate Platinum from Gold. We also allowed the children of Platinum members into our lounges, whereas we don't for Gold. They're limited to the one guest. We're continuing to find ways and to evaluate ways, or is there things that we can do? The big challenge that we have with tier benefits, like any airline, is a cost issue. It's a cost benefit analysis, right? Because I have my desires, and I've floated more that we can do for Platinums internally. But the issues that we have is, our ancillaries team, for example, thinks that, well, everyone should pay, right? And so when you have a customer base as large as Platinum is, relatively speaking, of course, the impact on doing something like that is a lot higher than is if you do it for a base for Ultimates, where it's much smaller base, and so we can afford to offer more. So it's always trying to find the right business case and to demonstrate, because it all comes down to cost, right? So how do we demonstrate that by offering more benefits that, yes, there is a cost to it, but that generates more revenue because we're more likely to have Platinum customers continue to earn Platinum status with us. As a result, it means more money for Air France KLM. Quite simply, that's the challenge that we have whenever we're looking at a new benefit. Doesn't mean that we give up. Doesn't mean that, we aren't continuously trying. And like I said, in the last year alone, we've already introduced two new benefits. So, I think that should hopefully go to illustrate and emphasize that, no, we have not forgotten our Platinum customers. In addition to things like being able to pick their seat options at time of booking, as opposed to having to wait until 3 days before for Gold. And as we, go ahead further with more economy comfort on Air France and have more of those seats available. Again, we hope that our Platinum customers will be able to benefit more from things like that. So all this to say, yes, we are continuing to work on that. No, it's not as easy as just coming out and saying we're going to do this. There's a lot of work that goes into it, but it's not something that we've forgotten.
Have you considered something? Because I also got a lot of questions from people in the US. Why do we get upgraded as loyalists to American or Delta or United in the US, but you don't get an upgrade to even intra-European business on Air France KLM? And one thought I've often had is that a nice benefit would be to offer like discounted upgrades, because I know you guys are great at monetizing those upgrades in the seat map when you're selecting your seat and then you're going to go check in and stuff. Is that something you've thought about where, as a Platinum, you might save a bit on that upgrade cost, for example?
The short answer is, the long answer, I should say, is in the US, people have become much more accustomed to the concept of free upgrades. You have almost all of the US carriers have their unlimited domestic upgrade product. So much so that it's, if you're number 57 on the upgrade list, sure, you're entitled, but it doesn't mean you're going to get the seat. No. Whereas for us, we don't give them away in that sense. But it also means that for our upgrade vouchers that we give to our Ultimate customers, you're almost guaranteed availability when you want to book, right? So it's a different model. The market has not demanded, complementary upgrades in the same way that the US has. So it's not something that we can necessarily say that we're looking at doing, one for one. I think when you're talking about the discounted upgrades, it's certainly a good idea, and one I personally like. But again, you have the team that's responsible for the upgrade saying, well, if a Platinum customer or non-Platinum customer, but if they're willing to pay, we're leaving money on the table by selling it for less than we could otherwise sell it for. True. So again, not to say the answer is no, because I'm very tenacious, these are some of the business cases that we have to that get challenged, right? And rightfully, that's their job, and that's how when you're looking at an industry that has 5% profit margin, you do everything you can to try to make money. So it's certainly an idea, and one I think that is good, and we can we'll continue to try to push. Whether that's discounts in cash or maybe we have a discount for Platinum members in if they book in miles, where it's more under our purview, we can look at that kind of thing. But again, it's more complicated, I think is the short answer.
Ben Lipsey, president of Flying Blue, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you
on
here today. I think we could talk for hours. So feel free to come back anytime. And,
thank you. Thank you so much. Always happy to. I'm a plain geek at heart, so always happy to. Always happy to talk about this.
So, are you guys super into miles and points now? Are you more interested, Alex?
This is the sound of me taking notes, right? That I've been doing throughout most of the chat. But also, I mean, great insights in terms of a potential competitor to Avios. It's quite extraordinary the dominance that Avios has as the currency for miles and points across so many airlines. It only seems natural that we need a strong competitor in order to, for the interests of the consumers to be served. So super interesting. Also, I like the way he set the scene about the expectations being so different and the airline realizing that between taking a 1 hour flight in Europe versus taking a 1 hour flight in the US and how it's very easy, as he said, to kind of be perceived as being the best when the bar is so low in Europe. But also how, you know, how few or little miles you need to be able to go from A to B and it becoming more accessible, and the fact that they have plans, because sometimes there are periods where we don't hear from airlines like Air France, where we hear loads from them and then I feel like we go 6 months without ever hearing anything. So it's nice to hear kind of what's on the drawing board and what their vision is going forward.
And especially from someone who, as I reiterated during the interview, is so passionate about this stuff. Because sometimes I've met or had conversations with people who head airline loyalty programs and they have no clue what this scene is about. They've worked in loyalty at a supermarket, like Ben was saying, or something that's completely unrelated. And they come in and they don't understand that psychology of having aspirational rewards or having something that, you know, just makes the program so much more appealing rather than just this is the monetary value of 1 point, because then what's the point in trying to engage with that? And as we sort of move into Q&A here, I'm sorry, this is going to be so unsatisfying because I'll put the music for the Q&A sometime, but it's a nice transition because our listener Marco, who was also on my group trip in Korea, sent me something that is quite topical based on this conversation, that basically Bernie Sanders has announced he's going to work with Donald Trump. So very different individuals, to cap credit card interest rates at 10% in the US, which compared to now, it's generally between 20 to 30 or even higher, 20 to 30%. So we're talking about a potential huge decrease, which of course will also have implications on the credit card market in the US. So a lot of people in the miles and points space are like, no, what is this? But of course, I personally feel like that's a bit selfish because you have millions of people stuck with this interest. And some people are just worried about their credit card rewards, but there are other ways to earn those points, guys.
Dan, perhaps you could offer every listener a free subscription to your miles and points tutorial program. What's the name of it again?
Oh, let's plug it. Oh my god, good co-host points there. It's called Points Master. Well, and by the way,
well, I am waiting for the point. You know what? Okay, sorry, I'm going to change the subject. I mean, you were going to do a by the way, but okay, go on, you do yours first. Go on. Well, sorry,
my by the way is about Points Master. Was your by the way about Points Master?
No, my by the way was about the Qatar Airways first class video that's still nowhere to be seen.
Okay, never mind about that. Let's talk about Points Master instead, because guys, what is coming up next week? Black Friday. So although I can't give away the program for free because hundreds and hundreds of hours have gone into it, there will be a massive discount starting on November 29th. So if you've been thinking about joining, that might be the time to go from newbie to knowing everything you need to know to fly business like I do, so you and I can meet up on a plane and Alex will be stuck on the ground because he has no idea how to do it and he won't be able to join us.
Listen, this is very rich coming from the guy that Remember which way around the upgrade worked, right? Remember I upgraded Dan, okay? And that video. So yeah, sure. Join both of us in the air in premium cabins, but don't believe any of his promises when he's got his camera out that supposedly there's going to be a video of it, because again, nowhere to be seen. My DMs are full of these questions. With that, let's move to Q&A.
No. You can't just leave it there. So we're going to waste precious time on this, because in my solo episode a few weeks ago, I gave a detailed, nice explanation to this, which includes the fact that the video has kind of taken a different direction because we discussed what should the contents be based on what I recorded. So that changed where I'm going to post it. It's now probably going to go on my vlog channel. But also,
We're flying to Bavaria.
I explained in that episode that I'm between editors for my vlog channel, and I truly don't have time to edit there at the moment.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, and I have to thank once again our on-air community, because after I posted that episode, I got several messages from listeners who want to apply to be an editor. How amazing is that? Oh, wow.
You know why? Because the listeners are on my side. They want the video to see the light of day, so they are willing to sacrifice their own jobs and become your editor just to achieve the publication of that video.
You know what?
Play the music and move us into Q&A.
I think we have a lot of listeners who actually just want to see what you're like in the unedited part. You know, they want to see every second of that video.
Play the parts that we want to cut out.
And guys, one last thing.
Into Q&A.
One last thing. Please stop commenting on my YouTube channel about this. I know. Guys, it's on my to-do list. It's on
my to-do list. It's the Alex Army. And guys, I see you. I feel you. I hear you. Okay,
okay, let's play the music.
And I am with you.
I'm fading you out as we speak.
Okay, I'll start. I have a question here from Lara. She says, with Iberia becoming the world's first A321 XLR operator, I am keen to hear yours and Dan's thoughts. Lara, the 321 XLR, of course, the extra long range variant of the A321. This is a single aisle aircraft. For those that don't know the technicalities or the terminologies, looks like, for example, your average EasyJet aircraft, 3-3 on either side, unless you're in the business class cabin. So it's a long aircraft, and the 321, you have the 321, you have the Neo version, the LR, long-range version, and the XLR, the extra long-range version. Iberia have become the world's first operator. They're flying it now on a route that they could otherwise use just a A321neo, but we'll talk about that in another episode. However, our thoughts. Dan, what are you thinking about this aircraft? And
let's repeat what we've said before on the podcast, which is, we are big fans of these types of aircraft when they fly from Gothenburg to New York, a secondary city. We are not fans when they are used for the not original purpose and they instead replace a wide body on a route where there previously was one, like Iberia is doing.
Agreed.
So
agreed.
Now
agreed.
It's being sent from Madrid, the capital of Spain, to the capital of the United States, Washington, D.C. This is not what we wanted, guys.
Very niche, that route. Yes. I don't think I've ever heard of D.C. or Madrid, no. So it's amazing that they've been able to connect these two cities. I think, yeah, you get the gist, right? Dan and I are definitely on the same page with thinking that the 321 XLR should be the route opener, right? So that you should just think it should be the enabler, the way that we think, wow, it's great that this place and this place are now on the map because of the economics and the efficiencies of this jet, not just downgrading a big old wide body to this and then the passengers getting on and noticing, this is small. That's the first thing. The second point is how difficult the reports are already it is to serve for the crew from this aircraft, because there is one tiny half galley. So it's half a galley at the rear for the crew to cater for a seemingly endless number of economy class rows. Sorry, I don't have the exact number on me, but anyway, majority of the aircraft,
just off the top of my head, I'm hearing 165, but that could be totally incorrect. That number popped up in my head when you said that.
Okay, so the fact that a long haul service has to come out of that. The constraints of a very small half galley is going to show up in the passenger experience. And for all reviews that have already been published, it already is. People have noticed that it's slow, it's difficult, you've only got one aisle. Also, though, every report says that there is a queue of about 8 people for the bathroom throughout the entire flight. Because economy, the only bathrooms on this Iberia 321 XLR are at the rear, and it only takes 2 occupants for it to be full. 2 separate occupants, by the way.
Yeah.
And 2 separate bathrooms. And so that's not ideal if you're sitting in the rear few rows and you've just got people standing over you waiting for the bathroom. There were reports of, you know, other passenger experience difficulties that come with the constraints of a small aircraft. So I don't love the case of Iberia XLR, but there are ways that this aircraft can be used in a better manner that will make us appreciate the aircraft more than it is on Madrid, Washington.
Yeah, well said. So I have a question here from Janik. I think, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. He says...
Maybe Yannick?
Yannick, maybe. I'm a huge fan of your work and the podcast. I haven't missed a single episode. Wow. I'd love to hear your thoughts on Qantas Project Sunrise. As someone who lives in Sydney and travels to London and New York regularly, I'd consider flying nonstop in a premium cabin, but the idea of spending 20 plus hours in economy sounds pretty rough, not to mention paying extra for it. Do you think there's significant demand for economy on such long-haul nonstop routes? If I'm correct, Singapore Airlines recently reduced premium economy seating, expanded business class, and introduced, well, they're planning to introduce first class on their nonstop Singapore and New York flights, which makes me question Qantas's approach. So, what do we think about economy for 20 hours? What do you think?
I think that sounds like something I would like to see you do from afar. And let me know how it goes. Connect to the Wi-Fi and I'll be there for you from time to time. No, in all seriousness, it comes down to that age-old debate, right? Would you rather ultra long haul in one seat or would you rather stop and stretch your legs? I think in economy, I would rather stop. I would rather make that stop in Singapore or wherever. But as an enabler, I like it. And also in terms of, you know, studying the economy of the aviation sector and aviation economics, the most profitable route for Qantas currently is the non-stop between the UK and Australia, specifically London Perth. That is their most profitable route. It's incredibly lucrative, and it actually, I can exclusively reveal, has triggered 2 other airlines setting up task forces to assess if they too will go ultra long haul, like a London Perth scenario.
Wow.
One of those airlines is British Airways, that is currently holding talks at headquarters Waterside in London as to the viability of a Project Sunrise-esque style flight that will ultimately connect London with Australia non-stop, either with a 350 or a 789 or a 7810 and so on. So it's caught the attention of the industry, that's for sure.
And the other one is Virgin?
The other one I can't reveal at the moment because
I would love if that was
very,
Virgin.
Very.
But anyway.
But I'll see if I can reveal it in time for next week. How about that?
We should just point out that there are quote-unquote only 140 economy seats on this aircraft, so it's not a ton. I think... Obviously, these flights are being financed by the premium cabins. That's almost always the case on ultra-long-haul flights like this. So first, business class, premium economy, those people will be paying for the economy passengers to come. I don't even necessarily think that the economy needs to be full or half full for those flights to turn a profit if they can charge ridiculous prices in a premium cabin. But
which they do.
Yeah, which they certainly will. I'm sure there are people who will want to do it just to rip the Band-Aid off. There are people who will want to connect, but ultimately there will be so few seats per day that it's not like, you know, there are going to be thousands of people faced with this possibility of having to sit there for 20 hours.
Dan, I've got a question here from Raphael. He says, is Black Friday genuinely a thing for airlines in terms of waiting to book and hoping for a discounted fare. He says, typically in the past, I noticed it wasn't, but increasingly airlines are advertising about Black Friday deals. Are they the real deal deals, or is it just a fad? He asks.
It's not. In my opinion, airline deals are never actually a deal. When they announce a sale, it's never actually a sale. Do you agree?
I do, yeah. I think anytime they say we're offering you X amount, you know, it's a discount, I think, well, that's because, you know, the revenue department had the flights marked up anyway, and they've just brought it down slightly, and then they're trying to tell you that bringing it down that would happen anyway is a discount. And remember as well that we're entering a period now where fares are expected to fall because load factors are beginning to fall and airlines are buckling up for what is set to be a quieter winter in the Northern Hemisphere. That should equate to reduced fares anyway. We don't really need to wait around for Black Friday for that. So I would say, you know, is Black Friday appropriate for Amazon? Sure. Best Buy? Probably.
Yeah.
But for airlines?
One airline thing where you do actually get good deals, maybe not better than sales throughout the rest of the year, but still you can expect sales, is on buying points, which ties into PointsMaster again, but that's the one date I'm waiting for because I'm
plugging it a lot in this episode. We're going to have to start. I'm going to seek the advice of the Advertising Standards Agency because I'm not sure. I don't know where in the contract of on air you and I, Dan, agreed that you'd be plugging your merch so much.
My merch. This is a life-changing course. Well, anyway, I need to run and plug my course a bit more and bolster it up so it's ready for an influx of you guys on, Black Friday. So
the class of Black Friday 2024.
Yeah, we will see you guys next week on air. Thanks for joining us today. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.